Hey, for those of y'all 13 and up, hopefully you can all benefit from this. I'm just going to issue a challenge to those of y'all that are about 13 to 20. I think y'all would find this interesting. The young part of my mind definitely did. So I'm going to challenge all y'all to stay attentive as well. So the truth was his life, Brother Robert Roberts. First off, why are we collectively spending an hour to look at Brother Roberts? Good question. First off, who is this guy? Who's Robert Roberts? Well, he was a Christadelphian brother. Agreed? He was a Christadelphian brother with a lot of energy towards the truth. He was a brother whose actions, and that's what we could see of him, showed an uncommon determination to live the truth. Because of that, his life's probably worth taking a look at. And that's why we're here. Collectively spending around an hour to look at the late Brother Roberts, because he's worth taking a look at. Now, before I go any further, I want to make something clear. Brother Roberts was a brother. He was not an apostle, nor did he ever claim to be. He was not a prophet. He was not inspired. He was a brother. Brother Roberts was a Christadelphian brother. Brother Vernon Hirsch is a Christadelphian brother. Gary Smith is a Christadelphian brother. Richard Hurst is a Christadelphian brother. Richard Wolf is too. That's what Brother Roberts was. He's not the patron saint of Goldthwaite or the patron saint of the Bereans. He's not at all the Joseph Smith of the Christadelphians. But his life is worth taking a look at. Now it's... That's to keep everyone awake. It is definitely different than looking at a Bible character, because we don't have an inspired account of his life. If we did, we'd know that everything that was recorded in that account was recorded for a divine reason, and so it was profitable for our consideration. That's the beauty of looking at lives in a divine record. Brother Roberts, though, wrote his own biography that was at the request of others, and while it does give us the opportunity to learn from some of his experiences, we can't really look at it the way we look at other Bible stories, which are full of types, shadows, principles, and allegories that are specially stored for us to find. We do have that for the apostles, for the prophets, the faithful of old, even for Christ himself, who's the supreme example. So what does a study of Brother Roberts, or any other character not found in scriptures, for that matter, have to offer that perhaps scriptural or biblical characters do not? Well, the biggest thing in my mind is the fact that Brother Roberts lived in a society that was very close to our own, at least compared with the society of the New Testament. We live in an age that's far removed from that of the Roman rule. Now, it is, mind you, still a human society, and it's driven by the same force of fleshly thinking that is found in any society, past or present. Our society, as well as the Roman, still produces sin, still influences its citizens towards evil. But today it's done with new and improved methods of deception. So hopefully a look at a 19th century brother will give us a more personal example, one that's perhaps easier to apply to our lives in some regards. I'm going to let Brother Roberts take the floor for a second. I have frequently been asked to write an account of my life. I've never felt sufficiently interested to make the attempt. My life has seemed so common as to be devoid of interest, and I have a feeling that all human life, as it now is so intrinsically weak and imperfect as to fail in affording the requisite enthusiasm for literary effort. Men are as they are. They're not as they appear in the atmosphere of narrative, but are best described in the sober and literal words of the Scriptures, which tell us that rich men are a lie and poor men vanity, and all the glory of man as the flower of the field. While they live, they are full of shortcoming and trouble, a fragile organization of corruption in the best state, and in a generation disappear one and all in native dust. Strongly sharing this feeling, I have hitherto refrained from the least record of a biographical character. If I make a beginning now, It is because I yield to the wishes of those I love, from whom I will pass away in due course of time. And that's from a book entitled Brother Roberts, or Robert Roberts, an autobiography, also known by My Days and My Ways, page 1. So Brother Robert's account of his own life opens. Now he goes on to set the background of his life. It doesn't tend to be the most interesting part of a person's biography, but I'll go ahead and throw it in there for y'all. He was born on April 8th, the year 1939, in Scotland. The town was Aberdeen in Aberdeenshire. That's, for those of you who aren't as keen on British geology or geography, which is myself included, Aberdeen's in the northeastern corner of Great Britain. I've got a little sound clip for you here. I'll see if I can play it. This is what a Scottish person sounds like.
What I want to do today is give everyone a little insight on how to speak Scottish, because as far as I'm aware, a lot of people seem to get it wrong. Mostly British people are going, I'm from Scotland, I talk like this. And we don't talk like that. Some of us sound a little like that from the southern area of Scotland, but...
Okay, that wasn't Brother Roberts, but well, hopefully you can get a little bit of a mental image as we read parts of his biography of what he might have sounded like. To give you a little idea of what his background was, his father was a seaman, and he later became the captain of a small boat, so he was away a lot, and their mother was responsible for much of the care of the 6 boys and 1 girl that survived in their family. There was 4 other children that his parents had who all died in infancy. The 2 boys older than Brother Roberts went to sea and became captains as well. So very much a seaward-minded family that Brother Roberts was brought up in. He describes his mother as a very energetic woman and of, in his words, a strongly religious turn of mind. Although they had a large family and they were dependent on a seaman's income, their mother brought them up with a very strict separation from what he calls the loose and frivolous neighbors. Home was, however, rather a place of wholesome discipline than of love's comfort, though my mother was not wanting on that side when other things were right. Looking back, I can now realize her difficulties and her worth as I could not at that time. Now, his mother was obviously a very apt parent, and I suppose anyone that admires the man Brother Roberts became should as well value his mother's admire his mother's value of proper discipline. It's something he certainly valued as a grown man. Now, Brother Roberts did not look at his birth as a happy event or one of celebration. He's actually quick to quote Jeremiah's words in connection with his birth by the time he writes his biography. Wherefore came I forth out of the womb, to see labor and sorrow, that my days should be consumed with shame. Woe is me, my mother, that thou hast made me a man of strife and a man of contention to the whole earth. And truly, that is how every follower of Christ should feel when looking at their life. Solomon makes it very clear to anyone who will heed a wise word that everything in life, even the highest of human lives, is vanity and vexation of spirit. Seeing this life as fun or good requires us to be disconnected from the reality of the world as it now is. It is a strong realization of how little this life offers us, of how many disappointments and failures it contains, that allows us to grow a fond hope for what Christ brings at His return. But, he says, there are many alleviations that make it easy for me to say, the will of the Lord be done. When Brother Roberts was 10 years old, he first heard Dr. Thomas speak. And Brother Seth gave us a little bit of an idea of how that went. I'll let Brother Roberts describe it. He says, Dr. Thomas was a quiet, stern, firm, neatly made gentleman with a jet black beard. His companion in the pulpit, what we would call a presiding brother, I assume, gave out the hymns and offered the prayer. Dr. Thomas delivered the address. I discovered from the remarks afterwards made, as the congregation were dispersing, that the address was regarded as something extraordinary, and that it was on baptism. The address had not struck me at all. I was too young to receive any impression. I had, in fact, wearied and slept under it, and was glad when it was over. The one thing that interested me and my brothers was the speaker's beard, which was a novelty in those days. As we went home together arm in arm, we vowed we should never shave. I had much occasion afterwards to know who this Dr. Thomas was. Now, I obviously can't tell you everything that happened in Brother Robert's life, much less give you my thoughts on it all, nor would you all want me to, especially in one sitting. As it turns out, earlier this year, Sister Amy and Sister Esther invited me to join them in reading Brother Robert's autobiography, which is the book I showed you earlier, and invited me to discuss it with them by email. So I scratched through the book as I read it, and just made little notes on things that caught my attention so I'd have something to say in the emails. So I suppose they both deserve a thanks for preparing me for this talk. I can't say I'll mention everything that's useful or interesting, though, not by a long shot, but I will try to present a few significant stories from his life that we can draw from. And what seems most interesting to me is not really the events that he talks about in his life, but the perspective from which he views them later on in his life while he was writing about them. Robert's first job was filling in temporarily for his older brother, and that was taking inventory at a rope cellar. He says it seemed very interesting work, as all work does to all boys till they get enough of it and more, and get to know what life as it now is really means. A struggle, a scramble, a merciless competition for mere liberty to exist. A state of things due to the larger and earlier circumstances that God hid his face from the human race for a season because of sin and left them to look after themselves, which they are not fit to do. And that holds as much truth in our society as it did in his or any other in the last 6,000 years. When Robert was about 12 or so, he developed a bit of interest in religion, and that was the result of one of those boys will be boys escapades. He says, this misbehavior consisted in staying away from the night school which I attended after I had begun to go to work. So I was playing hooky from night school. And in spending the time on the streets with a companion who regaled myself and my brother with all sorts of crazy delights from the shop windows to the ruin of health. This had gone on for some weeks, during which I was the unworthy recipient of my mother's pity at my deranged physical state. Being found out, we were summoned before the schoolmaster by the boy's father and subjected to an examination which made our teeth chatter with apprehension at the prospect opened out by their combined threats. The result of the examination was that we were to be handed over to our parents for punishment. Though this was not so bad as we had feared, previous experience made it sufficiently alarming. But the cloud blew over. My mother gave me an awful lecture, the whole force of which was taken away by the concluding declaration that she would not punish me herself, but leave me to the punishment of my own conscience, a punishment which at that time did not trouble me much. Although the terrors of conscience were not very powerful at that early age, I was miserable enough, notwithstanding. And when my mother took me to hear the excitable preacher, I was fairly overcome by his glowing representations of divine mercy for miserable sinners. I was in tears during his entire discourse and went home in a state of mind that lasted some time. My mother considered me converted, and her religious acquaintances rejoiced with her in the change and encouraged me in the new views of my state. I tried to respond to their ideas as earnestly as possible and became as absorbingly religious as was possible with me. I conformed to the recognized ideal of religiousness according to the standard in vogue among the Calvinist Baptists of Scotland. I had 6 months of tormented experience with occasional gleams of satisfaction as to which I adopted the view that God and the devil were thus struggling for mastery in my soul. I found great comfort in the reading of the sensational religious tracts which inculcated this view, and was especially solaced and encouraged by James Angle James's Young Man's Anxious Inquirer. It's interesting that that man had the same first and last name, same as Robert Roberts. Maybe that's why he picked him out so readily. In the reading of the Bible, though, I found very little satisfaction, and that only in a very few selected parts. Now, before long, Brother Roberts, he's hungry for more reading material, and he stumbles upon a copy of The Herald of the Kingdom and the Age to Come by Brother Thomas. He finds it in a neglected pile of books and pamphlets in their house. He says, the experience was extraordinary. I expected the usual sort of religious reading, dealing with the experiences of the soul in the light and shade of depressed and joyful feeling. But lo, here was a religious book that denied straight away in the first article that there was such a thing as an immortal soul in man at all, and then denounced the whole religious system built upon such an idea as a superstition. and an imposture for which the Bible was not responsible. I was startled. I was awakened. I was filled with new joy. The power of the article lay in its argument. Mere assertion would, of course, have filled me with aversion. In other words, he wouldn't have cared for it at all if the author had just stated that's the way it was and left it at that. But the scriptures were quoted in disproof of the immortality of the soul in a way that literally carried me away. The reason this article seemed so new and enlightening must have been the fact that while the young brother Roberts had taken quite an interest in the reading of religious publications, he had not taken the same interest in studying the scriptures. He found that from this article that the truth of the scriptures was something to be studied out and examined in a reasonable and logical manner by an individual, rather than simply being taught or passed down indirectly. I began to make inquiries which alarmed my mother, but filled my sister with satisfaction. Brother Robert soon found that the herald of the kingdom came to the house for his sister each month. She and her grandmother, on the father's side, had attended a lecture by Dr. Thomas 3 years before. This would be in year 1849. The two of them subscribed to one copy of the magazine. It first went to their grandmother, and then it came to Brother Robert's house to his sister before it was passed on to someone else. Brother Robert says he became a voracious and even excited reader of the Herald and the Bible. He soon got his hands on a copy of Elpis Israel from an older lady in his town and read it front to back. He said he had never, at that young age, experienced a purer pleasure than when he began the opening sentence of the book. And recall, he's 12 or 13 years old right now. His mother was not happy with the change in him. He says, though, about the change, the effect of Dr. Thomas's writings, while causing me to lose all taste for the religious literature which had for 6 months been my sustenance, was to impart a keen interest in the Bible, which before had been uninteresting to me, and led me to its daily and early and persevering perusal. My mother afterwards, 15 years afterwards, by the way, changed her mind and herself joyfully and thoroughly embraced what at first she condemned. That, I think, is really cool. First off, the effect of reading Dr. Thomas was that Brother Robert started searching out the Bible for himself. And that's the only way anyone can expect to learn anything of value religiously, is by turning to the Scriptures. If the reading of something does not produce in us the study of the Scriptures, we are not reading it correctly. If reading it alongside a study of the Bible produces conflicts, then we should move on to different material. If it does not, we should be that much more encouraged to read it and the Scriptures. The other thing that I love about this bit of story is the fact that his mother, once an enemy to his learning of the truth, eventually became what he describes as the most enthusiastic and admiring reader of Dr. Thomas's works that I know. Even though it took her 15 years to come to a correct understanding of the truth. After finishing the reading of Elpis Israel, and at the ripe age of 12, he resolved to have nothing more to do with church or chapel. The problem was the iron law of his house. But in his own words, I resolved to act at all hazards. He found out through the same woman who provided him with Elpis Israel that there was a small Christadelphian meeting, they weren't known by Christadelphians at this time, in the town, and he got her to take him to the place one Sunday afternoon. 20 or so common folk crowded into a 10 or 12 foot square room in the corner of an old castle. Brother Roberts attended the afternoon meeting regularly, but couldn't attend in the mornings because his mother required him to be at chapel. One Sunday morning, though, he says, I left the house an hour before usual time and made a long detour outside the town, avoiding on my return the road where I would be likely to meet my mother and brothers going to chapel, and coming in by a road that led me to the neighborhood of the brethren's meeting place. I do not remember what passed at the meeting. I know I enjoyed it. It was going home that was the anxiety. When Brother Roberts got home, his mother didn't say a word, but he could tell that there was a thunder in her face and manner. That night, after he'd gone to bed, his mother came and told him he was to attend chapel or leave the house. He told her it was impossible that he would attend chapel, and leaving the house seemed quite out of the question as well. His older brother, understanding the situation, came and took his side. And a compromise was reached wherein Brother Roberts would attend morning and afternoon meeting with the brethren, and evening he would go to chapel. Next Sunday he headed off to meet the brethren, much relieved, but the storm returned when his brothers asked him why he was so resolute in missing chapel. His reply was simply, "Because Mr. Anderson does not preach the gospel." When his mother heard this, she told him he was never to enter the church door again, and he couldn't have asked for a better punishment. "This was my final emancipation," he says. The unhappiness of home drove me to take a closer refuge in the Bible and in the companionships arising out of the understanding of its glorious contents. I've got to pause at this point, because the story we just read is exactly why we're having this study weekend. The truth is my life. No comparisons, no compromises, no reservations. There has to be a point at which it takes precedence before all else, where we resolve to act at all hazards, where we decide that no matter the cost, we are going to do what is right and pleasing to our Father. Regardless of the consequences of the truth, we are going to embrace it. At 14 years old, Brother Roberts was baptized in the River Dee, about a mile outside of town. He says a fisherman's hut afforded undressing convenience. It was a beautiful summer Sunday morning. There was a crowd of Sunday strollers on the bank who gave a loud laugh when the act of baptism was performed. Either that morning or shortly after, his grandmother and his uncle were immersed. It was about that time that Brother Robert started a structured reading of the Scriptures. It is now in general practice and known, I think, by every person in this room as the Bible Companion. He comments, "I found I must read first for information and then for daily sustenance in the things of the Spirit. Reading led to marking special passages with ink, arising from the need for ready quotation and conversation with those who oppose the truth." At first, his reading system was 7 parts, 4 from the Old and 3 from the New. He read in the morning and evening, respectively. It was then changed to 4, 2 at each sitting, and finally to 3 at one sitting, which he continued from then on, and which we still use today. Eventually, he made a written guide so that he could remember the passages for each day. And friends eventually learned of this and requested it enough that he started printing it under its current name, the Bible Companion. Our brother Robert stayed in a meeting in Aberdeen for 5 years afterwards. He worked with a druggist, what we would call a pharmacist, where he learned shorthand, and then he worked as a reporter. A few years later, he joined another brother in a visit to an annual meeting in Edinburgh. While he was there, this was a Christadelphian meeting, much like our study weekends, it sounds like, but focusing more on ecclesial business rather than encouragement. While there, a proposal to publish some things from Dr. Thomas's Herald was discussed. Strong opposition came on the grounds of copyright infringement. When everyone had spoken and the last appeal for further remark had been made, I rose and said I scarcely dared to speak, but it seemed to me the objection to the publication of good tracts from Dr. Thomas's works was one that should be left to him, and that I did not believe he would raise it, as we could not suppose that he would only rejoice, but that he would only rejoice at anything that would extend the knowledge of the truth. My future wife was present. I did not know it, for I had no acquaintance with her, but she has often since remarked that my words on that occasion committed themselves to her as a little young common sense in the midst of much senior fog. Soon after, Brother Roberts was offered employment in Edinburgh, which had a meeting of 70 to 100, which he describes as not very large. He was a reporter there. It was here that he connected with Jane Norrie, who had seen him twice before, but he'd never met. When I was introduced to her, I was drawn to her with a power that soon ended in the closest intimacy. She was my senior by 8 years. But this, so far from being an obstacle, was the reverse. It imparted to her a weight and sobriety of character that fitted her for the companionship which I desired. Girls of my own age were frivolous, One with whom I had tried to cultivate acquaintance with in Aberdeen asked me why I jawed so much about the nations. I might note this was during the Crimean War, and which Russia was heavily involved in, and the brethren were anticipating Russia's attack on Constantinople, or present-day Istanbul. There was no such repugnance of this sort to the truth about Jane Norrie. On the contrary, her tastes were all in the line of intellectual and scriptural things. There was an inexhaustible fund of interest in this direction, which supplied the material for conversation that never flagged. I met no one like her in this respect, and it was inevitable that our acquaintance should ripen fast, as it did, into the tenderest relation. I was only 19 when we mutually agreed that we were suited for life companionship. Some of our friends were scandalized at such a result, but we felt sure our decision was a wise one, and therefore, without making a secret of it in any way, we shut our eyes and ears and went on our way. Time justified our policy. Now, just after this arrangement, Brother Roberts made a mistake in an article over some controversy he was reporting on. The mistake was quoted by his employer and quickly pointed out by the opposition. Brother Roberts was frankly given notice that his employment was to end. Imagine how upset he must have been, being recently engaged, which many looked at as rash, and now faced with the prospect of returning to Aberdeen to push pills away from his dear sister in the faith. He was sure his employment in the publishing world was annihilated. Now, I want you to consider his situation for a moment. He's met a girl in Edinburgh he's very excited to be with. He's got a job there that he enjoys. He's finally found that the reporting field is a good field for him. And yet, now he's fired for incompetency in this field. And this was the first time he'd been employed as a reporter. When you make a mistake and you get fired, you can't expect anybody else in the reporting field to employ you. So now he's facing an engagement to a woman that he can't support by income. He's facing the prospect of no job. Even if he goes back to Aberdeen, he doesn't know if he'll have a job or not. Hopefully that hopelessness of that situation brings you back to a similar situation in your own life, where it seemed like all the solutions, all the doors were closed. And you didn't really have any way of moving forward. You had no solutions to your problems. But our Father has a way of providing, doesn't He? And typically He does so in ways that we haven't imagined. Brother Roberts goes on, "Before my notice had half expired, a gentleman walked into the reporter's room where I was sitting, and asked me cheerily if I would like to go to Yorkshire. I had never seen him before that I knew of. He was the sub-editor of one of the other Edinburgh papers, and said he had heard I was leaving and understood something of the insufficiency of the cause, and he had just received a letter from an old employer of his at Huddersfield in Yorkshire, asking him to recommend a Scots reporter, and if I was willing to go, he was willing to recommend me. The terms of employment were even better than those in Edinburgh. He and his companion were very pleased with the idea, under the impression that England offered everything that was genial and intellectual and spiritual. He'd return in 12 months to be joined by Sister Jane. After living in England, though, he notes in the story of his move, but in light of the ideal we had formed from reading, Yorkshire and the Midland countries, where we have spent 30 years of our life, or as the desert through which the panting and almost desperate, despairing traveler has to trudge his way to a hoped-for city beyond. Before his move to Halifax for his employment in Yorktown, Brother Roberts wrote to Dr. Thomas. He included a collection from a few in Edinburgh to help with Dr. Thomas's work in the truth. As well, he made a request that Dr. Thomas visit England for a while. In the letter, Brother Roberts also presses him to say a few words about our duty to share the truth. He says, "But many enlightened brethren, overlooking the duty, question the usefulness of public discussion, and discountenance or at least refrain from all effort in that or in any other direction. We therefore request a word from your lucid pen on this subject." Now, one of the most striking characteristics of Brother Roberts was his incredible desire to spread the truth. He was always looking for a way to preach. He talks in his account of his life about different stages of this ambition. For a while, he felt that personal introduction to the truth was perhaps most profitable. And he put his effort and concern into sharing the truth with acquaintances of his. After realizing very little success, he felt he must reach more than one person at a time. Doing such, those that are interested might make it known, and those without interest would not take any time from profitable preaching. He was very avid in finding ways to connect people with his public efforts. He was often found pulling all the resources possible, especially his own, to cover the cost of printing handouts or posters, or the rent of a hall for lecturing. He was ambitious about it too. Once he records the amount as 1,000 handouts and 100 posters distributed to advertise a lecture. The cost of that printing bill was far beyond the financial capabilities of Brother Roberts and his small ecclesia by most standards. But the determination to share the truth was so strong that the means would be found even when seemingly impossible. The effect, by the way, of that particular attempt was about 100 visitors to the first lecture. Dr. Thomas, in his reply letter, commends Brother Roberts' perception of the spreading of the truth as a duty to be performed, regardless of the success. As to the duty of the brethren in relation to the proclamation of the truth, though much may not be effected yet, as we do not know how much and when, it is our common duty to contend earnestly for the faith once delivered to the saints, and with as much energy as though we were going to hurl all ecclesiastical potentates of Gentiledom from their crumbling and tottering thrones. We do not believe in any of Christ's brethren purchasing exemption from this laborious duty. If they be rich or flush of mean, it is their privilege to give as well as to do. If they be poor, to do and to receive, which is less blessed than to give, that an equality may obtain. Note that Dr. Thomas's reply finds its strength of argument in the scriptural passage, "Contend earnestly for the faith once delivered to the saints." This is the force and value of any argument, whether coming from a pioneer brother or the youngest of Sunday school scholars. The idea wasn't right because it came from Dr. Thomas himself. It was right because it came from God himself. That in itself is probably the most valuable point to be taken from a study of Brother Thomas, Brother Roberts, or any other strong post-apostolic brother. They were strong because they relied on the scriptures. Now, the move was made by our brother to Halifax, and according to plan, he returned to wed his bride on his next birthday. There's a collection of letters between them during their courtship that I know many have found interesting, but I'll leave it for those who are interested to read themselves. It's on page 49 of the autobiography. At least that's the beginning of them. Now, as I said at the beginning, I can only pick and choose a few of the events in Brother Robert's life from which to draw lessons. I do want to include the visit that Dr. Thomas eventually paid to the Christadelphian community in Britain. There was an interesting difference in personality between Brother Roberts and Thomas that I thought a lot about after I read it. Before this visit, though, there's a couple of things worth mentioning. Brother Roberts moved between a few different jobs in the area. After recounting the end of one of these employments, he makes a statement that's worth quoting. He says, "If God be your guide, you may go ahead without fear. But he will not guide you if you don't go. Do not lie down, for that is death. Do not go ahead with recklessness, for that is tempting God. In modesty, commit your way to him, exercising your best judgment in the steps you pick in the labyrinth. And if you don't get to the ocean, you will at all events get to some wholesome highway where life will be tolerable during the present evil." Shortly after, he gave a good example of that idea in practice. He was employed by a medical lecturer. This was the phrenologist I commented on this morning, who felt justified in disguising the truth in a way that Brother Roberts could not agree with. The spirit of his employment did not match the spirit of Brother Roberts' service to the truth. He therefore ended his employment, not because it was a direct command of God, but because he had a desire to live in the best accord and atmosphere for spiritual growth, and that had been afforded him by God. Dr. Thomas eventually writes Brother Roberts to say that his situation would allow a visit to Great Britain. Brother Roberts is completely ecstatic. He says, "The time drew on for him to land. I was greatly exercised at the prospect of seeing him. It entered into my dreams, and my dreams were always disappointing. The doctor was always black. A photograph sent on in advance did not much reassure me. Brother Roberts and his wife watched each ship that came with the anticipation of an anxious child. When reading his account of it, his excitement seems excessive, almost childlike, like I said. And yet we have so much more opportunity for visits like this with one another. We are really blessed to be able to meet with distant brothers and sisters so often, but it is easy to take for granted. Dr. Thomas, when he arrived, had a crowded speaking schedule given to him by Brother Roberts. By this time, the doctor was fairly aged and must have found the speaking arranged for him by the energetic and young Brother Roberts a little overwhelming, but he carried it out. Not quite in the way Brother Roberts had anticipated, though. He says the doctor, just talking about the first lecture that Dr. Thomas gave there, Brother Roberts says, the doctor then rose and read the first chapter of Hebrews, making expository comments as he proceeded. We expected a rousing lecture. We did not get it. We did not get at all what is currently understood as a lecture. There was no formal elucidation of any proposition or proving of anything in particular. It was a process of reasoning out of the Scriptures. He digressed from the topics of Hebrew 1 to other parts of the Scriptures to which that led him. It was all rich and good, and to those who knew the truth, splendid. But as regards the public, we felt it was all over their heads and made them wonder what all the stir was about and what the fellow was driving at. We returned home with somewhat subdued feelings. My employer, the editor of the Examiner, and his lady were present. I had made glowing representations as to what might be expected, and I felt considerably taken down. There was no real cause for disappointment, because the genuine thing was all there. Only in its bearing on the public, I felt there was a failure. Subsequent experience did not alter this feeling. Occasionally, by a spurt, the doctor made a good rousing effort in his public lectures, but on the whole, there was an absence of that orderly method that is essential to secure the attention of the unenlightened to divine verities in an age like this. The fact is, the doctor had no enthusiasm towards the public. Experience had cooled it down. He went through his work as a matter of duty and did not care to come out of Bible methods in presenting Bible things to a public audience. The weeknight meetings were not much better attended. At these, there were some questions, and a new mortification came to us in the doctor's apparent want of readiness in dealing with these on the spur of the moment. This was due to the quality manifest in his lectures. He could not readily or quickly marshal his forces. He was choke full of matter in its correctest form, but he required time and no trammels to bring it out to its full advantage. Now, it's amazing to me how these two brethren could both be so strong and have such full agreement on divine principles and yet be so different. Was either better than the other? Well, is the ear the same as the eye? Is one better than the other? Each member of an ecclesia is different. If all, though, are in harmony with divine standards, they are all very necessary, and none more or less valuable than another. Brother Roberts notes over and again that any differences they had caused no decline of friendship, for the truth was the passion of them both. And there does seem to be a certain wisdom in the way Dr. Thomas is described by Brother Roberts. He was reluctant to make a quick response to biblical questions. He preferred the methodical and thoughtful approach of writing to share divine ideas. There's nothing wrong with that. When we're presented with a question concerning something so important, we should be eager to take the opportunity, but we should also be careful that our answer is thoughtful and correct. Brother Roberts shows to us ample eagerness. Dr. Thomas, thoughtfulness. Both are necessary. Both are required. The doctor left us in due course to keep appointments at various places in England and Scotland. I have bitten my tongue several times since at the recollection of the hard work laid out for him by youthful inexperience. Having no particular sense of fatigue in those days myself, I laid out the program on the time principle merely, without allowing for the recuperative needs of a man verging towards elderly life. I distinctly recollect supposing in the days of boyhood that there was a good deal of affectation in the allusions I used to see in the papers about speakers being exhausted by their efforts. It was part of my ignorance. We are all ignorant to start with. We think we know when we don't. Experience is the only thorough and accurate teacher. And it teaches by a quiet and slow process of tuition that cannot easily be formulated into words afterwards. It is made up of 1,000 mental accretions that can only come with varied experience and reflection of years. Hence the scriptural exaltation of age over youth. I must admit, I feel like I'm robbing you all by leaving out so much of Brother Robert's life. It really can't be done justice in even a week. There are so many lessons to be learned in an examination of even the most mundane life, and so many more in the life of a believer. These lessons are only to be learned by a tractable mind, though. A mind that's receptive to learning, that's dynamic, and allows its ideas to be molded, formed, even replaced. We have to make sure we have a tractable mind, or we can't gain lessons from anything. Of course, any narrative is interesting in some regard, but it takes the right mind to make it truly valuable. I want to wrap up with a few short comments or lessons from Brother Robert's life. First one I want to bring out is that moving, like making a house move, or any accepting any kind of drastic change in our life, really focuses how dependent we are on God. Don't be afraid of demanding or uncomfortable circumstances. Use them to build your faith. In sunny times, the truth loses its glow. But when we're in touch with the disappointments of life, it takes its proper place. We come closer to proper gratefulness when in dire times. It is then that grace is clearly seen. When we're given an opportunity, any opportunity, there are two important things to do: consider and act. Without proper consideration, the opportunities are ruined. Without action, the opportunities are wasted. When we are in touch with the spirit of the truth, we are coincidentally bold. The truth has a funny way of revealing itself in ambitious believers. And the last one, when our ambitions are right, God provides a way for our work to be done. When our ambitions are right. I'm just going to close with one last story from Brother Robert's autobiography. And it's one of my favorite. I think it kind of leaves us with a good ending point. So if everybody can bear with me for a little bit longer. I know it's kind of the lackadaisical afternoon time of day. But I'll finish up here real quickly. It says, about this time, there was a great stir in Birmingham caused by an Irvingite propagandist effort in a town hall, a large building capable of containing several thousands of people. The placard convening the meeting warned the Christian men of Birmingham to prepare for the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, which caused an alarmist sort of interest and brought together an immense assembly, half of which could not be obtained in the hall, could not obtain entrance into the hall. Among those excluded were the brethren and sisters who had wished to hear how a stranger would attempt to demonstrate a proposition in which they were so deeply interested. The night was fine, and the crowd hanging about the outside was large, and it was suggested the opportunity might be turned to account by holding an out-of-door meeting. A chair was fetched and placed in the square behind the hall, and one or two brethren went round the crowd to tell them that an overflow meeting would be held out there. The people accordingly repaired thither, and I mounted the chair and harangued them for the best part of an hour on the subject that was being spoken of inside. I received a fairly attentive hearing, till I came to speak of the Pope, when the Roman Catholic element of the crowd became uncontrollably turbulent and made a rush towards the speaker, which was resisted for a time by the peaceably disposed of the people, but at last carried all before it and compelled me to dismount. It might have been serious work, but for the two policemen who marched me off between them to the protection of a neighboring hotel, followed by a large crowd. The crowd stayed in front of the hotel, and I escaped behind and got quickly home. The hotel has since been pulled down to make way for a new Birmingham General Post Office, which now stands on its site. Now, this Irvingite propagandist, he decided, since there was such an interest the first time and so many people didn't get to hear, he'd hold another lecture the next week. So the brothers and sisters got to go to it, and they were quite disappointed. They were so disappointed, in fact, that they decided, even though they didn't have the financial means, that they would host a reply lecture and have Brother Roberts give the true, give a true declaration of the topic. He says it was a capital opportunity of getting the public ear on a subject for which usually there is no relish. But how to use it was the difficulty. The cost of a town hall lecture would be at least £20, which was too heavy a burden for our slender community at the time. Revolving the matter in my own mind, I felt so strongly exercised that I resolved, at my own risk, to take the town hall, give a reply lecture, and rely on a small admission ticket charge for providing the means. The brethren endorsed the project and heartily cooperated. The affair was not an entire success, but was saved from utter failure by individual enterprise at the last moment. A visit to the ticket depot 2 days before the meeting showed there was no likelihood of an audience. It was therefore resolved to distribute the tickets gratuitously or free and let the expenses take care of themselves. Brethren and friends each undertook the disposal of as many as they thought they could distribute. One sister, whose name it is scarcely for a husband to mention, particularly distinguished herself in the matter. In this way, 1,600 tickets were given away, and an audience of from 1,500 to 1,800 people got together. All felt their arduous efforts rewarded in the dimensions of the house. As for the expenses, they were finally met by the contributions of various friends. The whole episode afforded such an opportunity of giving a testimony for the truth in Birmingham as had never before been possible, and of advertising our routine operations in the Ann Street schoolroom, that's where they met each Sunday morning, by means of printed notices scattered on the seats before the people assembled at the reply lecture. The result was seen in crammed meetings in Ann Street schoolroom for some time afterwards. A special course of a dozen lectures or so had been in progress for some time. Many of those in attendance had attended the meetings for about 2 years. At this time, it was considered wise to address to them a circular, which was accordingly issued to this effect, that the faith originally delivered by the apostles having been steadily expounded in the Ann Street schoolroom for the last 2 years, it was proposed to hold an open tea meeting on Sunday, April 1st, 1866, at 2:30 p.m., for the purpose of giving an opportunity to all who believe the things that had been set forth, of declaring whether or not they were prepared to make that open confession of their faith which God required at their hands in baptism, as the basis of remission of the sins. Those who lacked the confidence to express themselves publicly could communicate their mind through others. The meeting duly came off and was largely attended. The addresses came first. Tea followed about 4:30, after which I gave a lecture on the spiritual dangers of the 19th century. As the result of the meeting, 23 persons signified their desire for immersion. They were all interviewed and baptized during the ensuing fortnight. On the occasion of their reception on Sunday, April 15th, the meeting was protracted an hour beyond the usual time, and addresses of encouragement were delivered by several of the brethren, new and old. Our numbers were now brought to 68. And I'm afraid I'll have to close there, but I might point out and encourage you all to get your hands on this book, because this is how much of Brother Robert's life we've looked at, and we've only looked at such little parts of it. And the lessons that I've received from this, and that I know Sister Amy and Sister Esther have from the discussions we've had, are invaluable. So the only way I can feel right about stepping off the platform now is to encourage each of you to pick up that book and read it, because it's a really easy read. It's a narrative, and yet there's so many lessons to be gained from it if you go into it with that in mind, that you're going to learn lessons from someone else's life.